I call the House Education Finance Committee to order. Good morning, everybody. First order of business is going to be to approve the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Purcell, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday?
Yes, and I move to approve the minutes. However, there's one spelling error for Representative Bakeberg.
Wonderful. Can we, are folks okay with us correcting that spelling error? All right. Yes, so Representative Purcell moves the minutes. Any questions on the minutes? With one technical correction, thank you. Any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. And the amendments are adopted. Minutes, not amendments. Minutes with the technical correction are adopted. With that, members, now that I took the training wheels off. We're going to begin today's hearing. We're going to have an overview from school nutrition from nonpartisan staff, and then we're going to move into an overview from the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board that we lovingly call PELSB. So with that, I'm going to kick it over to Mr. Strom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Tim Strom from House Research. There's a two-page document in your packets labeled School Nutrition Revenue. That I'll generally follow off of. I think Madam Chair prefers about 15 minutes in total on this part of the presentation. Please feel free to ask questions as we're going through the document. Also know that the Department of Education is here in the audience. They're the experts on the data. They collect the data for us. They're the ones we rely on to provide us information on the numbers of counts, numbers of participants, all that kind of thing. We've got a lot of great information on nutrition programs through the system that the Department of Education uses. And for school lunch, that system is referred to by its acronym, which is called CLICS. The National School Lunch Program has been with us a fair period of time. It was first established in 1946, and it provides assistance for school meals to students in both public and non-public schools. In Minnesota, there's about 670 participants, which is the name of the school district, the non-public school, or in a very few cases, the regional treatment center or other child care facility like a treatment center that's essentially the sponsor of the program. And within those 670 or so participants, there's about 2,000 sites that are providing meals to students. Out of those 200 sites, about 1,700 are public school sites, about 256 are non-public school sites, and about 47 are these residential child care and institutional setting sites. There are other nutritional programs as well, but the ones we're going to talk about today are the school meals programs, which include the lunch, breakfast, milk, and commodity support. The way the programs work is essentially the school districts provide food service. They can choose or not to choose to provide the different programs that are offered. So some schools will provide a lunch program but not a breakfast program. There are separate programs for snacks. There are separate programs for a la carte items that students pay for, and there's a school milk program that has two parts, a federally funded part and a part that's specific to the state for kindergarten milk, where half pints are paid for by the state for kindergarten milk for kindergarten students. Those nutrition programs are subject to a whole variety of rules established by the USDA. The Department of Agriculture is the program that program is through. Many of those standards are related to nutritional content. In past years, there were a lot of discussions about that, including whether grain should be whole grain, less salt content, portion size. All of that is very heavily regulated by the federal government. The nutritional programs, in terms of when they're served during the day and how they're served, are generally up to the local participant. That is, if a school district wants to run one lunch hour or seven lunch hours of a half hour each to accommodate that site, or have a breakfast to go program versus breakfast served in the cafeteria, those are generally local school decisions about how those programs are provided. In terms of the funding for school nutrition programs, these programs are primarily federally funded. The federal government each year establishes the eligibility rates for students for free and reduced price meals using something called the Federal Poverty Guidelines. The federal legislation says that a free lunch eligible student is a student whose family has 130% or less of the federal poverty guideline. Those poverty guidelines are adjusted for family size, so a family with three children would be in a different place on the matrix than a family with one child. The reduced price meals are set at 185% of the federal poverty guideline, and again there's a matrix showing by family size what that income is. For those federal poverty guidelines, those numbers are recalculated each year, and in the Federal Register, the Department of Agriculture sets those rates. Those rates then form the basis for the federal reimbursement rates, which are set separately by Congress for the different meals. Those again have a rather complicated schedule and can range depending on whether the state is one of the contiguous 48 states. Alaska has a different rate, whether the school site is a high need site or not, and then there's an additional a number of cents that are provided if certain other conditions are met. So the result of that means for school lunch, essentially, for a student who qualifies for the free school lunch, the federal government in Minnesota would pay somewhere between $4.33 and $4.58 for each lunch served to a student. For the reduced price meals at the national level, the federal government pays 40 cents less. So in many states, the reduced price parents pay that 40-cent differential per meal served. In Minnesota, for a number of years, reduced price meals have been paid for with a state adjustment of 40 cents per meal. So in Minnesota, all students, whether they're free or reduced priced eligible, are eligible for lunch at no charge. Those meal rates also include a rate that's paid for. The terminology that's used is a little confusing, at least to me. The federal government refers to fully paid meals as those that are paid by families that are ineligible for free or reduced price meals. So for the fully paid meals, there's also federal support for each meal that's served there, but that's quite a bit less. And you can see for the current year, that ranges from 77 to 93 cents for each meal that's paid. On top of that, federal funding, which is the primary funding for the program, the school meal service receives state aid payments of 12 and a half cents for each lunch served. And as I mentioned before, for those reduced price meals, another 40 cents so that those can be free to the reduced price eligible families. There's roughly, we'll see when the department is able to turn around the next year's data for us, but there's roughly a little under 100 million school lunches served in Minnesota per year in total. Those meals are reimbursed, as I said, by the federal and state government. There's quite a few fewer districts that participate in the breakfast program. Again, here the system's the same. The income eligibility is used. Then there's a federal reimbursement for the meals, again scaled by location and whether the facility is high needs or not. And then the state funding program is somewhat different. And a number of years ago, the legislature approved a program where kindergarten and pre-kindergarten pupils, regardless of their status, all qualify for a free breakfast at no cost to the student. But again, not all school districts will offer a free breakfast program. That's up to the local district to determine whether to offer that program or not. The other programs, very quickly, that I mentioned, the milk and the a la carte items are also provided out of the school nutrition fund. There are many federal rules on how those funds are kept and what a surplus, if any, can be used for. The boards, the local school boards, have control over where they set the price for the fully paid meals, but it's got to be within a certain range, and it's got to lead to neither a shortfall nor a surplus, essentially, within a band in the school meal fund. So some of your school districts will transfer general fund money into the school fund at the end of the year to balance that fund out. It's one of the more tightly regulated funds in Minnesota, in part because of the federal requirements. Madam Chair, members, for a couple of years, as members know, starting in the spring of 2020, special policies went in place due to the COVID and the pandemic responses. Included in those were the opportunities to provide free meals to all students during the first year after the March 2020 shutdown of the schools. Many districts provided those in different ways. Some used their bus system to essentially do a reverse drop of meals. Others set up places where the school would drop those meals during weeks worth of meals for the families during the week and that kind of thing. Those policies varied by district. There were a lot of different models that were used. One of the things about that, since all students were eligible for meals during those time periods, we have a bit of a gap in our data in terms of sort of consistency of who qualifies for free, reduced, and fully paid meals on the meal count basis. We're back to essentially normal order with the school nutrition programs, except that the rates this year are higher than what a linear progression of the rates prior to COVID would have been, and it's not entirely clear for the next school year where those federal rates will be set. If you turn to the back of the page, there's some more information on the calculation of free or reduced price meal eligibility. A couple of things I want to mention about that, in particular because because this count of students is closely tied to the state's compensatory revenue formula. The count is a very important mechanism. The amount of state aid that goes out on the nutrition programs is dwarfed by the roughly $700 and some million we're expecting to go out on compensatory revenue next year. So that count of state aid, so that count of free and reduced lunch eligible students is really important. The way that count is done in Minnesota is through two things, a direct match and what we often refer to as the paper reports. The direct match allows the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education to share data, and if a family is eligible for a program like SNAP or the Minnesota Family Investment Program, in past years the departments were able to match that data, and as school districts submitted their student data, there was a back and forth match between school districts and the Department of Education to let them know which of their students qualified for free and reduced price meals. This fall, something new happened. The fall of 22, the count, the direct match count was also able to match on another characteristic, and that's medical assistance status of the family. The Department of Education applied and was granted approval to participate in the program by USDA. And so since July, the department has been working with the Department of Human Services to include that count in the direct match as well. November forecast data was provided to us, and at that time the count was not complete, but the Department of Education estimated that 44,000 additional students were qualifying as free lunch eligible, and about 16,000 students were qualifying as reduced lunch eligible through the medical assistance match. So that's the big reason when one looks at the forecast documents to see the big jump in compensatory revenue of $200+ million between fiscal 23 and fiscal 24 is the additional 60,000 students who are being identified as free and reduced price meal count students through the direct match. There's also the paper forms, and school districts, even though we refer to them as paper forms, they often have that form online. But school districts also ask families about income status. There's a USDA-approved form that can be used to determine eligibility for free and reduced price meals that also is used for compensatory eligibility. And on that form, the family fills out and signs a document calculating their family income and whether they qualify for free or reduced price meals. The paper forms are required to be turned in the fall. Some school districts have very rigorous processes to get those forms turned in. And at this, basically by the middle of December, then the system's locked down for purposes of determining compensatory revenue for the following year. That's not true for free and reduced lunch eligibility for meals throughout the year if a new family is identified as qualifying for the the direct match, then that family's child can eat, or fills in the paper for it, that child's family can eat meals for the rest of that school year. I think that's where I'll leave the conversation on free or reduced price eligibility. And let me mention one other program that this committee is going to become familiar with. There's a federally sponsored program called the Community Eligibility Provision, and that's listed at the bottom of the two-page handout. The purpose of the Community Eligibility Provision, or often goes by its acronym CEP program, is to allow a school site to essentially provide free meals to all with additional federal reimbursement. The CEP program basically, it's not quite a direct conversion, but basically provides about 60% more funding to the site for each meal provided so that all students at that site can qualify for a free meal. Students with 62.5 or above percent free lunch pupils at the site have no, essentially receive full funding under the CEP program. Percentage drops from 62 to 40%, which is the minimum eligibility to participate in CEP, there's a greater share of the cost that's unfunded by the federal government. School districts do save money by participating in the program because they don't have to do the income checking, they don't have to for the non a la carte items, they don't have to make the account balances or the parent contacts about non-payment. So there are benefits to districts and sites participating in CEP even below that 62% level. There were federal proposals last year to lower that CEP threshold from 40% to 25%. Again, we'll see what the new Congress does on that, but for now, the minimum percentage for CEP eligibility is 40%. One last word about that. For those of you with school districts with more than one site, districts are able to match up sites to essentially make a consortium within their district for CEP eligibility. So sometimes the school district will pair a high and low income site together so that those two sites can both qualify for full CEP funding. Madam Chair, that's a very quick overview. There's a lot of information, a lot of ways that this affects the work of this committee. I'm glad to answer a few questions now, and of course, I'm glad to answer any questions members may have at any time on the subject or get them to the people who really know this information, which includes the nutrition experts in the school districts and MDE staff.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I want to open it up to member questions and Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question on eligibility. So say this is, you know, going to be a big debate throughout this session, I imagine, on school lunches. If a family's child is behind on their lunch, you know, they're not on the program right now, but they can't, they haven't submitted any money for it. Say their parents make $250,000 a year, but, you know, they're just terrible parents, don't take care of the kid. Is there any, if they submit for free lunch because they don't want to pay for it by saying they make $30,000 a year, is there any verification on that this indeed is a family that makes that much? Or can they just submit that paperwork and then get a free lunch?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative West, that's a good question. I don't know what the auditing procedures are. On the initial form, the parent signs and validates that that is their income. But I don't know if USDA or MDE has any auditing function to select a certain number of those to check income eligibility. That I don't know. I'll check on that with the department and get back to you if that's okay.
Representative Anderson, I'm just seeing if we have somebody in the audience to answer that question for us or not. But maybe we'll just count on Mr. Strom to get us the answer. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any estimates, now that we're doing more direct match, do we have any estimates as to what percent of families are getting caught through that? Idea being that we can just eliminate the paperwork, period.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. Yes, we're hoping in a week or maybe 2 weeks, but we're hoping in a week MDE is going to be able to turn around a lot of good data for us about this fall's collections. And we should know they did categorize each of the matches by a separate code number. So we should be able to determine how many were matched through medical assistance, how many through SNAP, how many through paper forms. We'll have a little trouble in terms of determining whether or not paper forms were replaced by medical assistance matching, because for the because the participation by filling out the forms fell off pretty significantly during the last couple of years when free lunch were provided for all. But we're hoping we'll have a pretty good estimate of that. The I think the guess is between somewhere between 80% and 90% of the students are going to be direct matched when we look at the fall 22 count. So there'll still be some portion, and it may vary a fair amount from district to district, that's paper form. But picking up that number of medical assistance students is going to improve the direct match pretty substantially. I believe the numbers I was told prior to the medical assistance was about 70% of students who were eligible for free and reduced lunch were matched on SNAP and MFIP data.
Okay.
Or the other couple of characteristics, homeless or Head Start eligibility.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, follow up.
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair. I guess the question, I mean, have we thought through, assuming that this passes, your parents are not going to have any incentive at all to fill out a paper form. They're just not going to do it because there's nothing for them. Has the state thought through that, because it could potentially lead to, you know, less federal dollars?
Mr. Strong?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that's a very good point. Some of the school district organizations that you'll be hearing from, that's one of the concerns they have. School districts do have different practices. Some schools currently are very aggressive about telling the families that this form affects not only eligibility for free lunch, but the money the school has available in the compensatory program. Some school districts actually call each family that hasn't responded with a form. I imagine some of the school folks here, perhaps our principal on staff with us, can tell us about Jordan's procedure. But I know those procedures vary a fair amount, and even if it's not a direct benefit to that family, that there are incentives and that some forms, paper forms, are turned in. But you're certainly going to hear from some of the school groups that this is one of the concerns they have with a free lunch for all bill.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up?
No.
And members should know that we are working on that compensatory link. It really strongly suggests, and maybe we'll have Mr. Fennec send out an email with the link to the Office of the Legislative Auditor report on compensatory aid. One of the big questions out there is really, is the free and reduced lunch count actually the best way to qualify kids for compensatory aid? Right now it's one of the indicators we use, and whether or not that's an accurate indicator is something that Representative Feist has been working on. So I also highly suggest you folks touch base with her as well, because I know we're going to tackle that before the end of session, hopefully. I've got Representative Edelson, and then we'll have Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just clarifying, we don't have a bill before us today. Just wanting to make sure. I you're anticipating it. It's coming, I know. But there's not one yet. So what I guess I wanted to talk about, Madam Chair and Mr. Strom, or Ms. Para, maybe you can address this. So over during the pandemic, we had lunches that were covered for students. And I know Mr. West is not here, but whether their parents make $250 or they make $30,000, students were gaining access to meals. And so whether or not their parents' income has to play with it, or if they're good parents or bad parents, that student deserves a meal. They shouldn't be the one that's having to pay the price for their parents. I guess what I want to know is, do we have any idea, because I know that the balances on a lot of these nutrition accounts have really skyrocketed for districts after families have been used to having this paid for. Do we know any idea for like a state total what the balances are?
Mr. Strong?
Madam Chair, Representative Edelson, we'll check with the department on that. Again, the issue we're going to face data-wise, the current year now, there's year-end reporting where we'll learn the balances in each district's nutrition fund and the amount of general fund transferred into that. I'm not sure that the accounting data captures the unpaid debts. We may have to reach out to several districts to talk about that. But we've got, because of the free meals provision for the last couple of years. We've got a bit of a gap, and so our data comparison will probably have to go back to the either the 2018-19 or the 2019-20 school year. So we'll have a little bit of discontinuity in that. But we'll do some checking and see if we can find any information on how much those unpaid debts have changed.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be really helpful because I know districts across the state of Minnesota are seeing an increase in that. And then the other thing I just want to say is this committee, since I've been here over the past 4 years, have really been dedicated to school lunch shaming. And I remember growing up, we had tickets that you had to have if you were on free lunch. I was one of those ticket kids. Then I still know that there are parents all across, you know, we dealt with lunch shaming, but still, if you have a negative balance, when that kid goes up to get their lunch, there's a red thing that flashes up, like, oh, negative account. If we don't think they're shamed to that, we're missing the point here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Adelson. You do remind me, too, that even though we passed that legislation, Legal Aid did a study on the policies across the state in school districts, and over 140 school districts still have those policies on the books. Mm-hmm. Yes, so Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And going back to the conversation about compensatory aid and how that affects, how we count school lunches and so on affects that. Does the federal government in their law require us to use the school lunch data, or is Minnesota allowed to use any means to determine the amount of compensatory aid? Who has the different requirements, or if that makes any sense, state, federal?
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, that's an entirely state decision. Up until 1996, the metric that Minnesota used as the proxy variable for compensatory revenue was actually the AFDC count. And so that was the measure that was used. Some states used a census count of eligibility. Other states used different kinds of measures. But up until 96, Minnesota used the count was simply based on whether the family was qualifying for AFDC or not. When AFDC was replaced in that year, the legislature then switched over to the free and reduced lunch count. At that time, the legislature did check with the Department of Revenue and learned there was no way at that point in time to match directly student information with tax returns to find a count that way. So the legislature put in place in that year, and it was a fairly quick change due to federal changes. The legislature went to the free and reduced lunch count, which was being used solely for meal purposes at the state level. But our state's compensatory system is entirely under your direction. You're able to choose the proxy measures, whether it's free and reduced lunch or census data information or other supplementary information to make that count. You're not limited to the free and reduced lunch form for purposes of compensatory revenue. However, that if you used a different form, for example, that had more or less information than the free lunch form, it may not qualify for the free and reduced lunch paper form. But how that formula is structured and how that money is, how that proxy variable is determined is entirely up to you all as legislators.
Representative,
Madam Chair.
Yep. Good to know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarifying question. I'm not familiar with that acronym, so if that can be explained, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Strong?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, I'm so sorry. The former food nutrition program for families was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC. And that was a longstanding program that was eliminated when a temporary aid for needy families was what TANF stood for. And in Minnesota, that was replaced by yet another acronym, MFIP, which is the Minnesota Family Investment Plan. So I apologize for the acronyms.
We sure do like our acronyms and alphabet here in Minnesota. I think nonpartisan staff still has a glossary of acronyms for us that you can get. Yes. Representative Jordan is emphatically saying yes. Any further questions on this subject, members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I do have one other, and I don't know who can answer this, but my kids have long been out of school, but that I've been told that the meals aren't great, and you know that How much control does a school district have over what is actually in that meal? And it's really a federal question, but does anyone know that answer?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think the school nutrition folks will tell you their version, and children may tell you their version of the quality of the school lunches. The nutritional requirements are very heavily monitored, and some of those changes in those requirements led to feelings about whether the meal was as good as it was before or not. Things like when some of the whole grains came in and required some of the reduced salt and things. Some of those, I think, led to reactions, particularly in the short term. Many of those changes are now 10 plus years ago. I think one of the big areas where some folks have had concerns about the school meals is on the actual quantity of the food provided. That's also something that's measured, and in some districts, I think, has been a bigger issue than others. But I think you'll find opinions vary by district and by students about the quality of those school meals. I think some school districts are very, very proud of the nutritional programs that they offer and the foods that they serve. There are small supplementary programs like the school-to-farm programs that are funded through the state's agriculture committee here at the legislature that provide local foods, locally grown foods as well. But I think each district, is best to comment on how they feel the constraints on their school meal system.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
I would also suggest people talk to their nutrition staff, that they can be, like you said, widely varied between districts. I have one district that had utilized money. In the 80s, there was this trend to, like, strip the cooking. Like, when I went to school a long time ago, they did scratch cooking. And then there was this trend in the 80s to rip out all that equipment and put in just, like, warming kitchens. So then you were getting a lot of processed and prepared foods in. And then some districts have flipped back, and I have one that did that, went and spent some fun, capital money into doing scratch cooking again. And some of the kids love that, and some of the kids are like, I want chicken nuggets and hamburgers again. And then I have another district who's really struggling to get past that just warmed up food and trying to find the money to put back in those scratch kitchens. So really reach out to your nutrition staff and have those discussions with them. It's really, really fascinating, down to the fact that buying pre-cooked ground hamburger for your tacos is more expensive than actually cooking by scratch, but yeah. Some kitchens aren't available to do that. And the constraints on budgetary constraints are really important when it comes to the types of foods they can serve, too. We've got Representative Backberg, and then Representative Cresha, and then we should move on to Pelsby.
I just wanted you talked about the portion size, and thank you, Madam Chair, I forgot. I'm still learning the process, thank you. But the portion size, and I just wanted to highlight, there are two programs. The Prior Lake Savage School District does a Try It Tuesday, so a lot of it is overcoming the barriers for kids about what they're used to eating. And it was just highlighted on Twitter where the food service director just did an awesome job. And that's really been the trend. And local districts trying different things. I recently chatted with our food service director in Jordan and the same types of things. So really, when we empower our local districts to make the decisions that are best for them, that's going to be best.
Thank you. And I represent Cresha, and then I forgot we have a nutrition testifier, too, that we can ask some questions to. Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And would it just be easier to call Representative Backberg up to the testifier stand every time we have questions?
Sometimes I feel like that.
Mr. Strom, can you talk about the relationship in the UFARS system with the nutrition fund balance versus the general fund and how they how that happens?
Mr. Strom, I almost demoted you. Sorry, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha. The school districts in their food service fund, well, let me back up one more acronym for you all that you'll hear a lot. UFARS is the accounting system, the Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting System, that school districts have used from the 70s and forward. And it's an excellent system for financial accounting. It's a crosswalk system with an 18-digit code that's assigned to each item so you can track its fund, its purpose, source, all that kind of thing. The Food Service Fund is a federally required and a state required fund. So in a district's accounting, in their books, they have a food service fund. if they, there are federal rules primarily about what to do if there's deficits or surpluses in that fund. There's also a little bit of state guidance about what to do on this, on the food service fund, but that's primarily reflecting what the federal requirements are. So in the food service fund, you can't run a deficit forever. You can't buy certain equipment for your kitchens out of that fund if you're running a certain deficit. There's lots of limitations on that. Those are primarily, almost all, I'd say, federally driven. We can share with you what the state standards are, but most of those are reflecting the federal standards for how the nutrition funds have to be handled.
Representative Kusha?
And so, Mr. Strom, to that point, so we have a food service fund. You can't run deficits. It's very well limited by the federal stuff. Can we move general funds into the food service fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Kusha, yes, you're required, as a district, you're required to fill that deficit. So essentially, it's a transfer from the general fund in.
Representative Kusha.
If there is a excess, can you move it to the general fund?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Kusha, I don't believe so. There are certain equipment uses there. And then, as I understand it, if the deficit reaches a certain size, the district needs to look at where it's pricing its meals at for the fully paid meals. Again, the department may be able to add some additional information on this. I'm a little out of my territory here.
Representative Kusha.
Mr. Strom, do districts generally carry a surplus or a deficit? In your experience, do you know?
Mr.
Madam
Strom.
Chair, Representative Kusha, I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Okay. And just the last thing on that. So just so I'm clear, so we have a food service fund that the federal requires them not to have a deficit in, and if that's carried with a deficit, they're going to move general funds into that. Many school districts have found ways to actually carry a surplus in there, and they can't move that back into general funds for academic natures and all that. So it's a one-way door, as I understand it. Okay, no further questions.
Thank you, Representative. And next up, I apologize. I completely forgot that we have a testifier that maybe could have, like, gotten all these questions out of the way before we even had them. So we have Darcy Stauber. She's the chair of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. So here is our expert. And could you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, I'm Darcy Stauber. I'm the director of nutrition services for the Mankato Area Public Schools. I'm also the public policy chair for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association. Thank you for having me today. On March 16th, 2020, Minnesota schools were closed to in-person learning due to the COVID-19 pandemic. As nutrition directors, we had to adapt quickly to serve meals to our students' needs. These methods of serving students at home varied throughout the state. Daily meal pickups, weekly meal boxes, meals put on bus routes and delivered to homes. The creativity was tremendous. During this time, we were also challenged with supply chain issues. Menus were changed and created on a daily basis. There were times where we did not know what was going to be on our food and supply trucks until trucks docked at our schools. We were great at adapting menus to food that we could receive and created continued stress as USDA nutritional and purchasing standards still needed to be met. School meals are well-rounded by providing lean proteins, whole grains, a variety of fruit and vegetables, and low-fat milk. Administrative adjustments that came from the USDA happened often. Often school nutrition programs moved from the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program to the Seamless Summer Option and the Summer Food Service Program. Like you said, we like our acronyms. So by moving to the SSO and SFSP programs, we were able to continue to serve free meals to our students throughout the pandemic. We were also allowed then to continue to serve free meals to our students as they move back into a hybrid or an in-person learning model. Honestly, the ever-changing waivers and flexibilities from the USDA was like drinking from a fire hose. During the 2021 and 22 school year, we were able to continue to serve meals at no charge. Looking back at this last school year, this was our pilot program to make sure that nutrition programs could serve students, all students, equitably. I know that student nutrition staff can support a universal meals bill, as we've done it before, March 2020 through June of 2022. After serving breakfast and lunch at no charge to families for over 2 years, how do districts return back to a paid program? Communication. Starting in July of 2022, my department started communicating with families that meals would no longer be provided at no charge to our students. Families must fill out an application for educational benefits, or some others know this as the free and reduced application. These were sent home through a nutrition service newsletters and by mailing them to home addresses. My district principals were my biggest allies. Applications went home in back-to-school paperwork. They were filling out applications at back-to-school workshop days, and one principal even created a QR code so families could swipe that code and go directly to that application. The response from families was tremendous, so was the administrative burden. My office staff of three processed applications 8 hours a day for 2 weeks. Along with processing applications, families needed to be notified of their status of their application result. In my district, that means mailing many letters. Yearly in October, applications need to be verified for accuracy. The percentage of applications are selected to confirm that they are filled out correctly. This results in hours of contacting families, having them send in documentation of income and reprocessing applications. At times, families lose their free and reduced benefit due to application error or not complying with the request for documentation. Every year, there are families that need assistance but do not qualify for benefits because their gross income is too high. Many times, these families with one adult income. Once taxes and health insurance are deducted, their take-home pay is greatly reduced. This causes families to make hard decisions on what expenses they can pay for with their remaining income. These are heartbreaking conversations to have. Because of this, they do not qualify for benefits. You have no way to help them. Most of these families will try and pay for meal debt, but will fall behind, creating unpaid meal debt for them and the school district. How the meal debt is collected is determined by the district. Most districts will send emails and letters. As the debt becomes uncollectible, some districts will send it to collections. At a certain point, it's written off and paid for by school district's general fund, the effect of the district teaching and learning budget. Nutrition programs are still maintaining the application for educational benefits during COVID. Even though meals are provided at no charge, the question may be why. This is because many programs outside the nutrition services are affected by the percent of students that qualify for free and reduced meals. Examples are compensatory aid. If Minnesota is going to pass a universal meal bill for all students, the compensatory aid formula must be fixed. As a nutrition director, my goal is to make sure that students have the access to nutritious meals so they can grow and be healthy learners and eaters. I'm also part of a district team, and when funding is negatively impacted, it also negatively affects the student as a whole.
Just need a quick second there.
Other examples of programs for funding tied to these free and reduced percentages: the distribution of pandemic EBT funds to families, district scholarships for sports and activities, different educational grants, reduced priced internet, funding and cost of field trips, and different state reports in the past have required needing to know the percentage of free and reduced students that are served in that group. For the 2022 and 23 school year, operations have evolved to our new normal. Students are back to paying for meals, application for educational benefits have resumed, continued communication to families to collect unpaid meal debt, working with adjusted staffing schedules as open positions are not filling very quickly. We continue to adjust menus due to the items either not being available from vendors, manufacturers have discontinued making items that meet the strict nutritional requirements for K-12 schools, or the cost of food supplies continues to increase. You should see my district's grocery bill. Amidst all of these challenges, we are in school nutrition, we love our jobs, and we know how important it is to feed these meals to our students and to help these families. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Duber. Before we go to member questions, I actually might have an answer for you, or we have MDE requesting to come up and testify. And then, Ms. Duber, could you stay at the table as well? and then we'll take questions from folks. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Department of Education, and thanks for the opportunity and the grace and time to recover the answers from the experts at the department. So I think there were a couple questions that Mr. Strom deferred to the department on because it's more of kind of an administrative answer. So I was able to go back on the excess fund question from Representative Creation and Representative Bakeberg, I think, or Representative West, my apologies, had a question on income verification process. So I'll tackle the first question. So the question that was kind of outstanding is, can excess funds in the O2 meal account be shifted over to general funds? And the staff of the department tells me that no, they have to sit in that account until they're resolved in one way or another. So they cannot be shifted into general funds. And then for the income verification process, districts and charters every year have to engage in a sampling process of their applications every year. There are several methods that they can go through for the sampling. The standard is an error-prone method, a 3% error-prone method, and then there's two alternate methods which are on a random basis. The error-prone method is based on a kind of a, I'm trying to learn as I go on it. We have documents that lay out the verification process, timeline, detailed documents, technical assistance available for districts to make sure that they get it right. But there is a document that spells out kind of the mathematical equations that you need to use for each of these methods for the sampling process. All of this requires a notification process to the family that they've been selected for the income verification process. And we provide translated materials for families for that where English is not their first language. So it's done in a culturally competent manner and that we're being helpful along the way. There are dates and times with which they have to complete the sampling process and then report the information back through us to the federal government. I'm still gathering the info on exactly what process they go to look at which exact forms that they can get from the family to be able to use for income verification. But again, there is a set out process that we have. We have the technical assistance documents, and it is based on a sampling process that districts have to engage in on an annual basis.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. With that, we're gonna go to member questions. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and thank you, Ms. Stuber, for your service to our students and families in the great work that you do. I wanna address the staffing shortage that I've seen in the local school districts that I serve, and in particular, anecdotally, the school district where I'm employed. It's not uncommon for us to see other faculty, staff members lending a hand when different schools are short-staffed or undergunned. Often it's those in principal and assistant principal roles. At times, it's our instructional staff that's lending a hand. And even district-level administrators. I've seen our director of operations several times scooping portions of food to our students. And, you know, my first question is how widespread and severe is this issue? From your role on the state level and what you're hearing, is this happening everywhere?
Ms. Stuber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is labor shortages throughout the state when it comes to our nutritional programs and throughout schools in general, especially parent education, I believe is an area where they're having some hard times with labor shortages. In nutrition programs, we are seeing that also. So we are leaning on other departments where the principal might serve for a day and hop in and help us out. Otherwise, we have had teachers or paras come in and help serve. You know, the concern is making sure that we get our students fed every day.
Representative Hill, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair Joachim. Ms. Stuber, my thanks to you for the work that you do and the important role you play in the education of our young people. Thank you.
As somebody who has as many vowels in their name as you do, I feel like I'm pronouncing it wrong. Is it Staber or Stuber?
It's Stieber.
Stieber. Third choice.
Married into it.
Pardon
Stieber.
Me. Pardon.
Yes. Thank you. And next up we have Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I'm glad you came up, Ms. Stuber, because, yeah, you could have answered a lot. Stuber, oh my goodness, you just said it, and I still can't.
I answered
them all. So you mentioned the sampling issue, mm-hmm. and you mentioned about a budget where money's moved around when there are lunch deficits. Mm-hmm. Do you know how much, either by percentage or ballpark total monetary value, is generally moved from that fund? And then just one more question, just so we can do it at once. Mm-hmm. When you do the sampling, how many people, either in percentage or raw numbers, are generally declined because of income verification issues?
Ms. Daber.
Thank you. So in verification process, it varies, depends on the district and how many applications they have, different things like that. So there's some different federal guidelines that we follow on that. My district follows a 3% error prone sampling. And so that means that I have to go in and it tells me approximately how many applications I need to go through and verify. And then it is collected randomly, the family's application is. I call it the unfortunate lottery in my district is how I explain it to parents, that they've gotten chosen for this. We have several letters and a process that we have to do throughout a month of October. We send out this information to our families. What they do is they need to fill out a new application, send us their information or their pay stubs. If they are an independent person, we might need some items from their W-2s and that type of thing, but we have to basically verify that the income that they receive is correct. And then we go through, check that income to make sure that it matches to the application, and then process the application, let them know what the results is. So most of the time we try and keep them on free meals if that's the ability. And from my personal experience in my district, a majority of my families are filling out these forms correctly.
Representative West, follow up.
So would you say when you do that review, does that mean like 40% turn out to be incorrect and are unable?
I would say approximately 10%. And usually it's in confusion on their part, thinking that they're putting down their take-home pay versus their gross pay. That's usually where we see the error.
Representative Kreshaw.
And I can wait to be at the end if there's other questions.
We have a few, but I also want to make sure we leave time for Palsby, so if people can make their questions concise, that'd be great. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine is a quick one, and I am not sure who it's for, but I know when we're talking about staffing shortages, I am wondering if we know how many women and men are filling these roles. And I know that they're both they're folks who are in food service who are employed by the districts directly and folks who are employed by contractors. And I'm wondering if we know the breakdown of that. So I'm not sure if that's you or MDE, but as we're talking about the folks who feed our kids meals every day, I'm sort of interested in what that workforce looks like.
Ms. Deber.
I could answer on behalf of my district. I don't know what the state requirements are or how the breakdown looks like for the state. A majority of my employees are female. I do have a few males on staff. I do also have a few executive chefs on staff. And so the interest in working in child nutrition is growing more and more as a nice career to get into so you can have a good family life. Restaurants, you're working nights and weekends. If you're working in school meals, you're usually off on Saturdays and Sundays. So we are seeing some interest in that direction. I know that I have one position that's been open for a year and a half that I've been still trying to fill. So we're getting there, but we still do have quite a few openings in our departments.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be quick. So do you need to do income verification on the direct matches, or is it just the paper forms?
Ms. Tiber.
Just the paper forms.
Okay. Thank you.
And then Representative Altidor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I know you were talking about, providing low-fat milk options, and my question is that federally mandated? And then just a real quick summary of that, but there have been studies that showed that whole milk is more nutritious for children. The fats provided in that are good brain food, and I think it was a Rutgers study that I would be happy to present. that shows that children actually drinking whole milk are thinner. The argument is when our children are drinking this low-calorie milk, they are not filled up, and then they take other choices later, like sugary pop and things like that. So my question, is this mandated? And then one other thing is our school district just recently went to bulk milk, which has been a huge success, and I would like to see other school districts really promote this because they're, you know, it's a better option versus the sugary drinks that they're getting.
Ms. Tieber.
Okay. Milk is is federally mandated. The nutritional guidelines come from our federal government. When we say low-fat milk, it's skim, and 1% is what we can serve in schools. So growing up on a dairy farm, I do understand the wholesomeness of whole milk. We drank it straight from the milk tank. But unfortunately, that is a federal mandate that we do have to follow. For when it comes to bulk milk, many schools are starting to move back that direction. Again, it's a labor issue for a lot of school districts because of the additional dishes and maintaining that program. And so carton milk is still quite popular with most of the school districts.
Okay. And we're going to go
thank you.
Representative Jordan and then Representative Cresha, and then we're going to move on. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. The sampling process sounds like a lot. Could you talk about what it would mean if you had to do that income verification for all students?
Ms. Tieber.
That would be a large undertaking. My school district is at 41% free and reduced kids. With 8,100 kids, you can do the math on how many children I'm feeding that qualify for free and reduced meals. If we had to do an income verification for every application, I would need to hire more staff, and that's for certain. So.
Yeah, Representative Jordan.
Thank you. And then a last follow-up. It sounds like you would like to see some changes made with the way the state funds school meals. Can you talk about what this body could do that would make your job better and would make jobs better for school nutritionists and school nutrition support staff across the state?
The thing that we could really use in school meals is we could use a universal meals bill. That would be huge. I know that that's not on the agenda today. But I know personally in my district, I have seen my meal counts go down. I know kids are going home hungry. So that is something that I would like to see for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. I represent Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your work. Mrs. Stieber, did I say that right?
That's correct.
Awesome. I have a question, and I know this can relate to, you know, depending on the districts, but what work is happening in your department on determining dietary options and nutritional needs for folks who have chronic illnesses and where dietary needs plays a large role in that?
Okay. Ms. Stieber.
Okay. So we are required that if there is a doctor diagnosed condition, that we work with that doctor's office. We have documentation that we have to do through the USDA to meet allergy and diet requirements. And so that we do work with doctors to make sure that students are receiving, you know, gluten-free or dairy-free diets, depending on what that diet looks like. I know we have 17 different menus in my district right now due to some special diets. So it's a lot of work on my dietitian's plate to make sure that these kids are getting the meals that they need that are nutritional and wholesome, and then also meeting their dietary restrictions.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Stieber. So, Finance Committee, I want to approach this from the Finance. So, you have a school fund account, and maybe Mr. Strom, let me start. Maybe Ms. Stieber, if you can answer. But we've established that we can move general fund dollars in. Can we move compensatory dollars in to the school fund account?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, compensatory revenue is set aside for the particular purposes in statute. So basically what a district would move is its undesignated general fund money that's not set aside for another purpose when it moves it into the food service fund.
And Mr. Strom, can we move compensatory into general fund?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, compensatory is in the general fund. It's a restricted amount in the general fund, but it lies within the general fund, Fund 1 of the school district.
Very good. But we're clear. It's very restricted on where you can expend those dollars.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, there's a long list on uses for the funds in Section 126C15. There's 11 uses, I believe, currently that are quite broad, but it has to be for one of those 11 uses. As the chair mentioned, in 2020, the Legislative Auditor's Report has a nice section describing that broad list of uses, but it is limited to those uses that are in statute.
Representative.
Thank you. And just so we're clear, one of those uses is not nutrition in the school fund account, school lunch account.
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, several of those uses are pretty broad, but my guess is that because of the way school districts handle these kinds of set-asides and funds, that they would simply move any of the undesignated general fund money over. But I guess I can't say for certain whether, because some of those uses for compensatory include things like helping student achievement. And so if a district made that argument, I suppose maybe they could. But from a technical point of view of how they transfer funds, it's just so much easier for them to just use undesignated money that I'm guessing that nearly all would do so, even if they could make the argument that that would be a use of that fund.
All right.
Okay, thank you. And so,
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And so, Ms. Steeper, on the school fund side, the school fund balance that you manage, there's cost and revenue, mm-hmm. and there's cost for providing those meals. The district gets to set those prices. Is that correct?
Ms. Steeper.
Yes, that is correct. At our district, we take a look at our expenses and revenues. We try and forecast the best we can on what we're going to be receiving for funds that will fall into our free and reduced categories. And then also of our full paid, we try and estimate what our revenue will be for the year. And then also estimate against our rising costs that we are currently incurring with expenses. And then we do go to our school board and ask them to set our our paid meals price. Free and reduced students eat at no charge. So that price designation is made by the school board.
Correct.
Representative Kreisha, one last follow-up.
And I'm sorry, I do have about three questions. I want to get to the technicals of this. So I would ask the committee if we're going to stump for bills that aren't in front of us, that I should be able to get my line of questioning.
Representative Kreisha, we're going to be moving on. I'll give you two more questions because we do have other members here, another overview here that I know you guys are going to have questions on as well. So we'll have time for this. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let me ask it this way, Ms. Steeper, then, in a comprehensive way. So we, on the revenue side, and really I'm just trying to understand the finance side because we're going to move money. You, on the revenue side, have three ways to set that revenue. You have full price paid, you have those that may not pay, and then you have free and reduced side. You can set the prices for that. You, by federal law, are not allowed to carry a deficit, so the school district could move money, and they do move money from the operating, but they probably can't do it from the compensatory, which we've already established is higher related to the free and reduced. So I get all those connections. Could a school district, and really the question here is, could a school district, if they wanted to, reduce the cost for all the students to whatever level they want, go into the operating fund to offset that, and then pass an operating levy to come in and cover that? What I'm seeing here is there's nothing in statute that prevents a school district from addressing this issue locally. Is that correct?
Ms. Tieber.
I would say that's not correct. I'm not familiar on how operating levies work. I don't know of any districts out there that would like to go to the public for a vote and ask for an operating levy to cover the cost of meals. I don't know if that is something that they can do. So that's a question I don't know about. But I do know that the free and reduced rates that we receive from the government and the state, those are set for us. The only rate that we do set is the price that the paid student will pay. We have to take into consideration that it needs to cover our costs of the meals, labor, and any other expenses that we have in that meal. I run very similar to a private business, if you will, in my budget, because I do not want to incur a negative debt to send back to the general fund, which is coming out of our teaching and learning budget. So for myself, I want to make sure that I'm running a break-even budget.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just a final wrap up.
Representative Kreisha, could you please go through the chair? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Madam Chair, all I want to say is all I'm asking for is it technically could be done. Whether or not a school district wants to, how they want to position their operating revenue is not what I'm asking. I'm just asking, and maybe Mr. Strom, and this came offline, is I'm trying to figure out other ways to solve this deficit. I'm trying to solve that. We're a finance committee. Technically, it could be done. A school district could pass an operating referendum to supplement dollars in the general fund to supplement that we do with everything else. So I appreciate your answers, and I'm not trying to pin you anywhere. I'm just trying to understand. I mean, this is, we're moving dollars. We're dealing with revenue and liabilities. So, Madam Chair, no further questions.
Okay. Ms. Tiefer, did you have any final comments? Otherwise, it sounds like a perfect discussion to take offline with our nonpartisan staff. Ms. Tiefer.
I have no further comments at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, members, for the spirited discussion. We are going to move on to an overview from the Professional Educators Licensing Standards Board, and it's much easier just to say PELSBY, another acronym. Please approach, set up your computer, and then we will have you introduce yourselves for the record. I love the hand motions to talk. It's amazing. If you want to go ahead, we have Dr. Yelena Bailey, Interim Executive Director for PELSBY, and Michelle Heschvogt, the JD for Rulemaking Authority. So, Dr. Bailey, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Dr. Yelena Bailey. I am the Interim Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, otherwise known as PELSBY, and I have my colleague here with me today, Michelle Heschvogt, who is our rulemaking attorney. We are going to try to briefly give you an overview of PELSBY's work and jurisdiction, as well as highlight some key data that will give you a picture of the teacher workforce right now, and then discuss some of our rulemaking efforts. I do like to start, though, with PELSBY's mission, which is ensuring all Minnesota students have high-quality educators in their schools. And then our vision is to ensure equitable education practices through high licensure standards, quality educator preparation programs, and stakeholder engagement. PELSBY itself is made up of an 11-member volunteer board. It's a mix of classroom teachers. We have administrators, principals, superintendent, as well as a representative from teacher preparation and higher ed. That board oversees the work of our staff at our agency, which is currently 21 members, and I'll share in a little bit the scope of work those 21 members, including myself, cover. But that involves a licensing and operations manager, a director of ed policy, which is my other role, and then staff that work on licensure and compliance, on board administration, and then teacher preparation and policy work. So this will give you a brief view of the many, many tasks that PELSBY covers. You'll notice that number in the left-hand corner at the bottom there, that is the number of dedicated staff members we have to each one of these buckets of work. So we oversee right now 38 teacher preparation providers across the state of Minnesota. Those include providers at higher ed institutions, alternative providers, who it might be nonprofit organizations or school districts. And those providers then oversee about 760 programs. Those are licensure area specific, so elementary programs, secondary social studies, things like that. We also oversee licensure and compliance, and so that involves working with our nearly 113,000 licensed educators in Minnesota, or teachers specifically, I should say. We issued last year in 2022 about 9,600 new licenses, and then we issued 4,100 permissions, so those are kind of out-of-field permissions for teachers who maybe have a physics license and want to teach a course in math. We issue a permission to do that. And then finally, we processed over 26,000 renewals. In addition to that, we gather data each year from about 530 districts and process that as well. Our board also does a significant amount of policy work at our board meetings, so we hold a regular monthly meeting and then special meetings when required. So last year we held 13 board meetings, as well as a retreat. Finally, we oversee educator ethics, and so that involves kind of discipline cases, but thankfully we only had 63 actions taken last year, And given the contrast to the 113,000 licensed teachers, that is a very small number, which is a good sign for our profession. I will highlight here the rulemaking, and you'll notice the one staff member, which I have here to my left, who oversees that. So for those who maybe aren't familiar, Pelsby was created in 2017 and began our work January 1st of 2018. We took on the kind of jurisdiction and work that used to belong to the Board of Teaching, as well as the licensing department at MDE. And so part of our mandate was to revise all of the licensure and teacher preparation rules, and so rulemaking has been a major part of our work here at Pelsby. We currently have three active projects, which you'll hear about a little bit later on. And then finally, we do administer two grants. Many of you are familiar with the Q grant, which is now the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educators of Color grant. We oversee that to help with recruitment efforts, and then we do oversee and administer the teacher mentorship and retention grant. So I will turn it now to my colleague to discuss a little bit of tiered licensure, which is a very easy structure to understand.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Hirschfeld, and I'll be spending the next few minutes to briefly walk over the tiered licensure scheme, give a snapshot of our licensed teachers, and then finally wrap up with some recent board actions our board has taken to support districts and teachers this past school year. So as Dr. Bailey mentioned, Pelsby was created in 2018, January 1, and our tiered licensure system went into place at that time. It's made up of four tiers. I'll briefly walk through each of the tiers, but know that we are available for questions anytime after this to dive into this more in more detail. Our Tier 1 license is a one-year license, and notably it's tied to a specific teacher, a specific district, and a specific assignment. All of our tiered licenses require a bachelor's degree, but please note there is an exemption for our career and technical pathways educators, so those fall into this system as well. Moving to our Tier 2, it's a two-year license. Again, it's tied to a specific teacher, assignment, and district. Jumping to our Tier 3 and 4 licenses, these are mobile. They can be used in any single district across the state, and they're held by the teacher tied to a specific licensure scope. So grade levels and then a specific field. This is for folks who have completed teacher preparation. Perhaps they held a professional license in another state and taught for 2 years, went through the licensure via a portfolio pathway. And then finally, we have a Tier 4 license. So after you've been on a Tier 3 license for 3 years, many of our Tier 3 teachers are able to move on to a Tier 4 license. For many of our tiers, testing is required, but at that Tier 1 level, it's not. And then for many of our pathways to a Tier 2 license, testing is also not required. The data you see before you is our teachers who hold either a Tier 3 or a Tier 4 license and how they obtained that. You'll note that most of our teachers from Minnesota who received a license in the past year came through a teacher preparation program either in Minnesota or out of state. And then finally, I'll note that the other number is due to the fact that our data systems are often linked together and sometimes we have a few missing gaps. So we know these 444 people hold a Tier 3 or 4, but we'd have to manually go in to get those. So that's something we can do at request, but we hope, knock on wood, that our data systems just continue to get better and that moving forward we just have these numbers. I'll end with actions our board has taken to support teachers and districts in the past school year. Our board recently put into place a policy to allow out-of-state teachers who are seeking a Tier 3 license to use their out-of-state exams. Previously, they would have to come into Minnesota on a Tier 2 license, complete our state-specific exams in order to obtain that Tier 3. So this expedited the process for a lot of those out-of-state teachers. We also removed the posting requirements for teachers who would need an out-of-field permission in order to teach in a licensure field or outside of the grade level that they currently teach. That posting of 15 days was removed for the school year, so districts could immediately shift a teacher into that assignment. And finally, we restructured staffing and support for our licensure via portfolio process. With that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Bailey to walk through some of the data.
So we have a fresh set of data for you. This will come from our biennial supply and demand report, so you all receive a copy of this on February 1st. But we pulled it in time to share some highlights with you today. So this lets you or gives you a sense of the individuals who currently hold a teaching license in Minnesota, both the number of individuals across racial ethnic groups and across the tiered system. One thing I will highlight here, because it'll give you some context for the following slides, is that overwhelmingly, over 100,000 of our teachers that are licensed here hold a Tier 3 or Tier 4 license. I bring that to your attention because you'll notice there is a higher proportion of BIPOC teachers who hold a Tier 1 and Tier 2 license, but of a much smaller number. So when you see 28% of, you know, Tier 1 teachers being teachers of color, that's 28% of 1,100 versus, you know, 10% of 100,000. So that context, I think, is important. So if you go to the next slide, this gives you for each of those tiers how that is broken down proportionally across racial and ethnic groups. So for all tier one teachers, what proportion of those or percentage of those are American Indian, Alaska Native, Black, Asian, et cetera. The next slide shows you slightly different information here, which is for each racial ethnic group, which proportion of that group holds each tiered license. So amongst our American Indian or Alaskan Native educators, what percentage of those hold a Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4. So again, just giving you some different perspectives on our teacher workforce and what licenses they hold. This data comes from a different source I do want to highlight. So we get our data two ways. One is through licensing, and the other is through the district reporting that we do annually through the STAR report. So this comes from STAR data, which is only reported on active teachers, and by that we mean teachers who are not only licensed but working in a public school district or charter school. And so this gives you a sense amongst each region, economic development region, the number of teachers that are working in that region, as well as what percentage of them are on each of the tiers. And then this is probably one of our more popular slides, which is again coming from that district reporting data that shows you the comparison of active teachers with the student population, and particularly giving you a sense of our students of color in comparison to our teachers of color, because we know that that is a definition and statute of a shortage area until we close that gap in terms of students of color having teachers that represent them. So I do want to point out on this slide, though, that this percentage of active classroom teachers of color at 6.2% is higher than the about 5% overall teachers of color we have licensed. So when it looks at not only licensed but in the classroom, it's slightly higher. Still not great, but slightly higher. So that is worth noting. And then finally, we did want to share with you some data on our enrolled teacher candidates to give you a sense of, you know, future supply. So we get this reported annually from our teacher preparation providers, and we have about 17%, I should say, of our candidates are people of color. So that is hopefully a good sign for our profession.
I'll end our presentation today walking through our active projects as well as our process before turning it over for question. Since 2018, Pelsby has been heavily engaged in rulemaking in part to implement both the tiered licensure scheme and permissions, as well as to update the teacher preparation rules in order to better align those to the new tiered licensure scheme. So on the two columns to the left under licensure and teacher preparation are all policy changes that we've enacted in the past 5 years. The board has now moved to reviewing the teacher licensure standards. These are standards that are for teachers, adult standards, that are often included in teacher preparation programs or that are used, that a teacher would use as part of the licensure via portfolio process to demonstrate that they are capable of obtaining their license. The board has three active projects, all of which contain teacher licensure standards. And just as a highlight of our process, the board is very dedicated to intensive stakeholder engagement. So our rulemaking subcommittee meetings are open to the public. Our board meetings are open to the public. We release rule drafts early and often. And all of this is in addition to us meeting the requirements in Chapter 14 that governs the administrative rulemaking process. Our projects at this point are typically taking around 2 years. But as we've become more versed in this, we are able to speed this process along, in part because of our heavy stakeholder engagement process. With that, we hand it back.
Thank you. Actually, I do notice that you do have one final slide on here, if you want to touch on that. the short call subs?
Yes, so short call subs have been a topic of interest and over the past year, and so we wanted to highlight what we're hearing, what the board has done in the past school year in an effort to support both our teachers and schools, and then a possible solution. So over the past year, we've heard two things, that our substitutes are not teachers, that there are people that are ready for the classroom to serve as substitutes that aren't currently qualified. And then we're also hearing that our Pelsby staff aren't able to prioritize these applications fast enough. So first, dealing with the application piece, we have hired temporary workers in an effort to expedite our substitute teaching applications. That still is in place to this day, and we do not hear this complaint or concern as we've implemented this. We also are engaged in a rulemaking project that would move the ability for a short call sub to serve in a classroom from 15 days to 20 days. Again, this is meant to help teachers who are out of a classroom have a substitute come in. This does not necessarily address the teacher shortage in general. And then finally, in an effort to address the substitute qualification issue, we do have a bill that we hope to see move forward that's similar to bills that were seen last year that would remove the bachelor's degree requirement in two specific circumstances, one for folks who hold an associate's degree, and then also for ESPs or paras who've already served in a district for 1 year to allow those individuals to serve as a substitute teacher.
Thank you. Thank you both, and we'll open to member questions. I have Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and thank you to the both of you for the work that you do on behalf of our young people. Dr. Bailey, I have one question. I'm trying to understand the number of licensed teachers who are currently serving students. And I'm trying to reconcile slide 6 or slide 11. It's either somewhere around, quick math by an English teacher, 55,000, 53,000, or it's 81,000, and I'm trying to figure out which number is accurate.
Dr. Bailey.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. So this is a great question. We have, to recall, we worked on this report yesterday. I think somewhere around 65,000 active licensed teachers in the classroom, and that includes for all tiers. Might be closer to 70, but you'll notice there is a gap. So something that often comes up is that we have, you know, at least another 40 to 50,000 licensed teachers who could help fill some of the shortage. One thing I will share, and be happy to send to you all committee members and send to the chair, is that we did recently conduct a teacher survey to ask questions of all licensed teachers, including those who are not in the classroom, questions about, you know, why you are not in the classroom, what are the factors that impact that. So we will happily share that report, but that gap is something that we have been beginning to investigate, and we're hoping to conduct that survey in a little more detail in future years as well.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and thank you, Dr. Bailey. It is a question that I've wondered about over recent years, and that idea that we have so many licensed educators who are not or are choosing not to serve students at this time. So that survey data will be very interesting and very useful. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Bailey, for being here. I was wondering if you could go into more details about the portfolio option for licensure and the changes that Pelsby has made. In the past, I've heard feedback that the portfolio process is cumbersome for candidates. And so I'm just wondering if you can fill in some of those gaps for me today.
Dr. Bailey.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, that's an excellent question. Thank you for giving us the chance to speak to that. So for those who are not less familiar, the licensure via portfolio allows someone who perhaps does not want to go back through teacher preparation because they're either adding a license or they have, you know, work or life experience to get a professional license, a Tier 3 license, by demonstrating they meet these standards for both the profession, which we call the standards of effective practice, as well as the relevant content standards for their licensure area. And so often that looks like submitting, you know, lesson plans, assessments, things like that. Historically, we've had very limited staff. We had one staff member running this for the entire state, and, you know, old you know, paper portfolios, things like that. Over the past, I would say, year and a half, we've done a number of things that we're very excited about. One is to move this from into the department, small again, we're a small agency, but the department that oversees teacher preparation, because it is to make that a department of pathways to licensure. So we have staff now that are more deeply familiar with licensure standards, actually reviewing and helping work with reviewers to guide the way they assess these portfolios. We also are working with an outside vendor and have created a online platform that makes this process much smoother so that people can upload their materials, including they can have videos of themselves teaching in the classroom and use that as a way to demonstrate how they're meeting standards. So this is something new that we'll actually be rolling out and that we're very excited to make this kind of a more accessible thing. The other piece I'll add, we found through conversations with several different stakeholder groups, particularly with our heritage language and culture educators, that a lot of the barriers have been just understanding the process. So we spent probably 6 months overhauling our guidelines and information and publishing that online and disseminating that to the different educational organizations that we work with. You know, not surprising maybe to some, but half of the barrier for many folks in government is just understanding what the processes are. So those are some of the key things we're doing because we really do believe that if we want folks to meet the standards of the profession, we have to make it accessible by removing the barriers that keep them from doing that. So, yeah.
Thank you. Members, we have about 5 minutes left and three folks with questions. So if we can keep it brief and answers brief, otherwise you can take it offline. Representative Spencer Murrow.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Dr. Bailey. Thank you, Ms. Hirschbott. My question is around a topic that I know that we've talked a lot about in this committee in the past, which is, you know, recruiting teachers of color. I know there was some news that came out, I think, about a month ago, talking about, and I don't know if this is a question for you or something for MDA, but the $400,000 that was earmarked to support school districts in recruiting more teachers of color, and just kind of how some of those efforts had fallen short for this first year, and specifically some of the kind of licensure requirements and how that was tied into it. So I don't know if you can kind of speak to that and what you're doing, or maybe if the folks from the MD can talk about what they're doing to improve that program. Thank you.
Thank you. If, Dr. Bailey, quickly, otherwise we can get follow-up information to Dr. Bailey.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I will say that that article specifically is referencing the teacher, I think it's the bonus program that's overseen by MDE. I do know we have partnered with them to target that as much as possible and to do good work there, but I think they would have to fill in some of the details. We have a few other things that we're doing on our side in terms of funding for teacher candidates to recruit them in, working with higher ed, and then the teacher marketing and recruitment campaign, which is geared towards kind of different social media and other ways to market the profession.
I look to MDE to follow up with the Come to Minnesota program. Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. You mentioned the 27 and 24% rates among the category of the BIPOC for 1143 and 3,273. What does that exactly mean? Does that mean that group of teachers is coming in through the Tier 1 and Tier 2 and moving up? So that is their entry point?
Dr. Bailey.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Krisha. So it means that simply that is the percentage of Tier 1 holders that are teachers of color. We haven't seen in our data, we see a mix of folks who actually move up and many who just leave afterwards. So we don't actually have good evidence that they are, in fact, using it as an entry point to move up the tiers. But we can say that of those who currently hold the license, of that 1,143, or, you know, that 28% of them are teachers of color.
Representative Keisha.
Two quick things. So it must be an entry point because they're not coming backwards. You're not going from three down, right? You're going one up.
Dr. Bailey?
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, so that's maybe to help clarify. On the few times we have been able to pull data, it's a mix. Some of them, individuals who held a Tier 1 license, let's say 2 years ago, now no longer hold a license. So they're not necessarily moving up because they just leave the profession altogether. Some of them still hold that Tier 1 license. They haven't moved up. They're still Tier 1 holders. And then a small group do in fact get a Tier 2 license. So we don't have strong evidence that those Tier 1 holders are actually an entry point to get their full professional license, but we can say that at least amongst those that hold that one-year license, we tend to have this as the percentage that are people of color.
Representative Krisha, one more question.
Thank you.
Someone
and
else
one last thing. So has any progress been made? I know you were, I think it was last October, on compliance with the federal expectations for students with disabilities. That was an issue that was out there. Has any, what's changed since October?
Dr. Bailey, that may be an MDE question, but go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I will say we have been in conversation with MDE to respond to that and are working on different ways that that can happen. It falls, much of that is involved in districts, specifically kind of local control districts, as well as working with MDE on funding. So I would defer to them to speak to that.
Thank you. We'll ask for that for follow-up as well, because I have some similar questions. Representative Clardy, you have the last question.
Thank you. Great presentation. Just so you know, I used to be on the predecessor board, Board of Teaching, so I'm familiar with the structure. I really like that you removed the obstacle of letting teachers use their accreditation from the other state or their, the other state as far as getting licensed here. And I think that will help with recruiting and hiring teachers that are of color. Could you tell me where the Q money is being directed? You had mentioned that you had that earlier.
Dr. Bailey.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representatives, we have about, I believe, currently 8 institutions that are grantees, and overwhelmingly they're using that for direct support for scholarship funding. So we do have them using for some towards mentorship and, you know, kind of cohort models, but almost entirely these funds are being used right now for scholarships to give a free or reduced education to get to their teacher preparation programs.
Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Chair Yukim, and thank you, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bailey and Michelle Heshvote for coming today. And I'm sure folks have other questions. We'll make sure people get their follow-up questions answered, but don't hesitate to contact them. Their information is right on the slides. With that, we're adjourned.